An hour later, Spot stumbled through the door, waving the papers and bawling hysterically.
It's over! It's over!
He kept wailing as I held the petition for involuntary bankruptcy. Margaret Wright, the secretary, and Hardy, the pressman, came from the back and tried to console him. He sat in a chair, face in hands, elbows on knees, sobbing pitifully. I read the petition aloud for the benefit of the others. It said Mr. Caudle had to appear in court in a week over in Oxford to meet with the creditors and the judge, and that a decision would be made as to whether the paper would continue to operate while a trustee sorted things out. I could tell Margaret and Hardy were more concerned about their jobs than about Mr. Caudle and his breakdown, but they gamely stood next to him and patted his shoulders. When the crying stopped, he suddenly stood, bit his lip, and announced,
"I've got to tell Mother."
The three of us looked at each other. Miss Emma Caudle had departed this life years earlier, but her feeble heart continued to work just barely enough to postpone a funeral. She neither knew nor cared what color jello they were feeding her, and she certainly cared nothing about Ford County and its newspaper. She was blind and deaf and weighed less than 80 pounds, and now Spot was about to discuss involuntary bankruptcy with her. At that point, I realized that he too was no longer with us. He started crying again and left. 6 months later, I would write his obituary. Because I had attended college and because I was holding the papers, Hardy and Margaret looked hopefully at me for advice. I was a journalist, not a lawyer, but I said that I would take the papers to the Caudle family lawyer. We would follow his advice. They smiled weakly and returned to work. At noon, I bought a six-pack at Quincy's One Stop in Lowtown, the black section of Clanton, and went for a long drive in my Spitfire. It was late in February, unseasonably warm, so I put the top down and headed for the lake, wondering not for the first time just exactly what I was doing in Ford County, Mississippi. I grew up in Memphis and studied journalism at Syracuse for 5 years, before my grandmother got tired of paying for what was becoming an extended education. My grades were unremarkable, and I was a year away from a degree, maybe a year and a half. She, Bibi, had plenty of money, hated to spend it, and after 5 years she figured my opportunity had been sufficiently funded. When she cut me off, I was very disappointed, but I did not complain. To her, anyway. I was her only grandchild, and her estate would be a delight. I studied journalism with a hangover. In the early days at Syracuse, I aspired to be an investigative reporter with the New York Times or the Washington Post. I wanted to save the world by uncovering corruption and environmental abuse and government waste and the injustice suffered by the weak and oppressed. Pulitzers were waiting for me. After a year or so of such lofty dreams, I saw a movie about a foreign correspondent who dashed around the world looking for wars, seducing beautiful women, and somehow finding the time to write award-winning stories. He spoke 8 languages, wore a beard, combat boots, starched khakis that never wrinkled. So I decided I would become such a journalist. I grew a beard, bought some boots and khakis, tried to learn German, tried to score with prettier girls. During my junior year, when my grades began their steady decline to the bottom of the class, I became captivated by the idea of working for a small-town newspaper. I cannot explain this attraction, except that it was at about this time that I met and befriended Nick Diener. He was from rural Indiana, and for decades his family had owned a rather prosperous county newspaper. He drove a fancy little Alfa Romeo and always had plenty of cash. We became close friends. Nick was a bright student who could have handled medicine, law, or engineering. His only goal, however, was to return to Indiana and run the family business. This baffled me until we got drunk one night and he told me how much his father cleared each year off their small weekly, circulation 6,000. It was a gold mine, he said. Just local news, wedding announcements, church socials, honor rolls, sports coverage, pictures of basketball teams, a few recipes, a few obituaries, and pages of advertising. Maybe a little politics, but stay away from controversy and count your money. His father was a millionaire. It was laid-back, low-pressure journalism with money growing on trees, according to Nick. This appealed to me. After my fourth year, which should have been my last but wasn't close, I spent the summer interning at a small weekly in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas. The pay was peanuts, but Bibi was impressed because I was employed. Each week I mailed her the paper, at least half of which was written by me. The owner-editor-publisher was a wonderful old gentleman who was delighted to have a reporter who wanted to write. He was quite wealthy. After 5 years at Syracuse, my grades were irreparable, and the well ran dry. I returned to Memphis, visited Bibi, thanked her for her efforts, and told her I loved her. She told me to find a job. At the time, Wilson Caudill's sister lived in Memphis, and through the course of things, this lady met Bibi at one of those hot tea drinkers' parties. After a few phone calls back and forth, I was packed and headed to Clanton, Mississippi, where Spot was eagerly waiting. After an hour of orientation, he turned me loose on Ford County.